Welcome to our exploration today. We are so incredibly glad our beloved family members have gathered with us for this conversation.
Yes, warmly welcome everyone. We have a genuinely fascinating study ahead of us today.
We really do. It touches on this profound, kind of lingering feeling I think every single one of us has experienced, even if we couldn't quite put a name to it.
Right.
Today, we are looking at a remarkable piece of theology. We're exploring a truly powerful sermon centered around one of the most famous, yet perhaps most heavily sanitized and misunderstood statements in human history.
Matthew 5.6.
Exactly. The profound concept of being hungry and thirsty for righteousness.
It is a remarkable sermon to examine. And the central mission of our conversation today is to figure out exactly what that specific phrase means for us right now, you know, in the reality of our modern world.
Because when you hear blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, It sounds like a lovely poetic idea on the surface.
Yeah, it sounds like calligraphy you might frame and hang in a quiet hallway.
Exactly. But the sermon we are studying today unpacks this single sentence in a way that is actually incredibly disruptive.
Highly disruptive to how we normally structure and live our daily lives.
And I think that disruption begins with the sheer, bizarre paradox of the blessing itself. Jesus said that the hungry and the thirsty are the blessed ones.
Which is, I mean, think about how entirely backward that sounds to our modern sensibilities.
Totally backward. We organize our entire human existence around the avoidance of emptiness.
Right. We spend our lives building systems, securing careers, and accumulating resources specifically to ensure we never have to feel the ache of a hollow stomach.
Or the desperation of a parched throat. We universally equate fullness and satiation with blessing.
And we equate emptiness and longing with suffering.
Which is an entirely logical way to operate when you consider the historical context.
Right. Back when those words were first spoken on a hillside in Galilee, literal physical starvation and dehydration were daily looming realities.
For the average person, yeah.
To tell a crowd of first century laborers and outcasts, people who genuinely didn't know where their next meal was coming from, or if the local well would run dry, that their hunger was somehow a form of ultimate divine favor.
It would have been a profoundly arrestive statement.
It demanded absolute attention because it inverted the reality of their physical suffering.
And it's fascinating how the sermon zeroes in on that contrast between their reality and ours. Because we live in an era of unprecedented historical affluence.
We do. For the vast majority of our beloved family members joining this conversation today, extreme physical starvation is not a daily threat.
Thankfully, no. But our affluent society actually masks a severe spiritual dehydration.
That's the kicker.
Because our stomachs are full, we trick ourselves into believing we are entirely self-sufficient. We think the absence of physical hunger equates to a state of complete wholeness.
We've mastered the mechanics of caloric intake, but the sermon makes the compelling case that eliminating our physical starvation didn't actually eliminate our hunger.
It merely relocated it.
Exactly. That illusion of self-sufficiency is exactly what the sermon targets. Our innate primal desperation hasn't vanished simply because our basic survival needs are met.
Because our physical stomachs are full, our deep existential thirst has transferred to other things.
We are now deeply, chronically thirsty for other forms of satiation. We thirst for momentary pleasure, undeniable success.
Impenetrable financial security.
Yes. And the constant validating popularity of our peers.
We are arguably more parched on a psychological and spiritual level than any generation before us.
Precisely because we have so many false remedies at our disposal.
Yeah.
And the mission of our study today is to uncover why this sermon urges us to take that intense, misplaced thirst and redirect it entirely toward this singular concept of righteousness.
It's fascinating that the sermon zeroes in on that specific word, righteousness, because I think modern culture has given that word a lot of baggage.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, let's unpack this, because if you ask the average person on the street what righteousness means, they might say it means being a good citizen.
Following the rules, paying your taxes on time.
Returning your shopping cart to the proper stall. Or maybe just possessing a polite desire to not harm anyone.
But the sermon redefines it entirely. It strips away that civic duty aspect.
The sermon defines hungering for righteousness as a burning, intense, desperate craving to live according to God's will. It's not a polite preference for goodness. It is a primal urge.
It is the stark difference between saying, I wouldn't mind a glass of water right now if you're getting up, and saying, if I don't get water, my body is going to shut down and I'm going to die.
Wow. Yes.
The sermon points out a deeply fascinating dynamic here, a sort of upward spiral of thirst. In the natural biological world, when you drink a glass of water, your thirst is quenched and the desire fades away.
But in the spiritual framework laid out in the sermon, this thirst operates on an entirely different axis.
Counterintuitively, the closer you get to God and the more intimately you know Jesus, the hotter and deeper this thirst actually becomes.
You don't reach a plateau of satisfaction where you can just check out.
No, you become more desperate to resemble him.
But wait, doesn't that sound incredibly exhausting?
How do you mean?
Well, if this spiritual thirst never actually goes away, and in fact only gets hotter and more demanding the closer you get to the source, how does the sermon reconcile that with the idea of finding peace or rest in faith?
That is a very fair question.
Because if I am always starving, it almost sounds like a recipe for perpetual spiritual burnout.
That raises a really important tension, and it's a tension the sermon addresses beautifully. If we view this purely through the lens of a transactional task.
Like trying to fill a leaking bucket with water.
Exactly. It would be utterly exhausting. But the sermon frames this upward spiral of thirst not as a lack of supply, but as an expression of love.
Think of it relationally rather than mechanically.
Precisely. When you deeply love someone, spending time with them doesn't permanently quench your desire to see them again.
Right. A great conversation with a loved one doesn't make you want to avoid them for a month.
It actually deepens your capacity to want more of their presence. The thirst for righteousness is a relational longing that expands the soul.
Which fundamentally changes how we view spiritual health. It flips the script on how we measure our own faith.
It really does. Usually when we achieve a goal in life, the desire fades. You get the promotion you've been working toward, and the hunger for that specific promotion is instantly gone.
But here, the hunger itself is the evidence of life, which brings us to the sermon's most severe warning.
Yes.
If the presence of this intense, expanding thirst is the definitive sign of a healthy spiritual life, then the ultimate spiritual red flag is losing it.
The danger of complacency is heavily emphasized in this section of the sermon. Losing that thirst, feeling entirely satisfied with your own spiritual state.
Feeling like you've successfully checked all the moral boxes and no longer need to seek God with any level of desperation.
That is framed not as maturity, but as a critical, life-threatening danger.
It's like a spiritual numbness. If your physical body is exposed to freezing temperatures and you suddenly stop shivering and feel completely warm,
you aren't safe. You are in a medically catastrophic situation.
Your body is shutting down its warning systems. In the same way, the sermon suggests that feeling entirely full and self-righteous is the spiritual equivalent of freezing to death while thinking you're sitting by a fire.
The sermon uses a brilliant biblical analogy for this reality. Just as a human body cannot survive a single day without water, a spiritually alive soul must experience daily spiritual dehydration.
Meaning, you must wake up every single morning constantly craving God all over again.
Recognizing that yesterday's grace doesn't cover today's thirst, the sermon quotes Psalm 63:1 to illustrate this state of being.
What does it say?
It says, "O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh faints for you, as in a dry and weary land where there is no water."
That imagery of the dry and weary land is so evocative. It forces us to confront the reality of the environment we live in.
It really does.
The sermon is suggesting that the world we walk through every single day, despite all its shimmering distractions, its entertainment, and its comforts, is spiritually barren.
It simply doesn't contain the water our souls actually need to survive.
And acknowledging that barrenness is the first vital step toward genuine spiritual health.
When King David wrote that psalm, he was literally wandering in the wilderness of Judah, fleeing for his life. Yet his primary lament wasn't his immediate physical danger or his literal lack of water in the desert.
His overarching, all-consuming desperation was for the presence of God.
The sermon uses this to prove that truly knowing God doesn't mean you have all the theological answers neatly filed away in a cabinet.
It means you are desperately seeking him, constantly, acutely aware of your own profound need.
It's an active daily pursuit. It challenges the very common modern notion of faith as a static achievement.
You don't just get it once and move on. You wake up thirsty every day. And honestly, for any of our beloved family members who might be feeling a deep, aching desperation or a sense of profound longing in their lives right now, I think this is a deeply relieving concept.
How so?
Because we are usually conditioned to view a feeling of emptiness as a failure. We think, if I feel spiritually dry, I must be doing something wrong.
Yes.
But according to the sermon, if you feel that intense, aching need for God, you are doing it exactly right. The ache isn't a disease, it's a blessing.
Yeah.
You are spiritually alive.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, the sermon does something very crucial in its next movement. It transitions the conversation away from this deeply personal, internal piety.
The individual soul thirsting alone in the desert.
Yes. It transitions from that to the profound, unavoidable community impact of that thirst.
This is a massive paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. The sermon makes it crystal clear that the gospel has a dual nature.
It is deeply, fundamentally personal, absolutely. It is about your individual heart and your individual soul.
But it is also highly, undeniably public.
The sermon argues forcefully that loving God absolutely must translate into loving one's neighbor. You simply cannot have one without the other.
If your supposed thirst for righteousness only makes you feel peaceful and pious in your living room, but doesn't change how you interact with your community,
then it's not the righteousness described in the text.
The sermon frames human history in a way that is profoundly uncomfortable, but undeniably true. We live in a world of predators and prey.
From the dawn of civilization, it is a world where the strong consistently and constantly devour the weak. Power exploits vulnerability.
We see this written across the pages of history, and we see it deeply embedded in our modern economic, legal, and social systems today.
In this context, hungering for righteousness takes on a much heavier, much more demanding mantle.
It means believers must crave God's justice in their societies and communities just as desperately as they crave their own personal holiness.
That requires a completely different level of craving. It's not just, I want to be a morally upright person.
It's, I am starving for the systems around me to reflect the equitable justice of God. I can't be content with my own full stomach while my neighbor is being exploited.
And the sermon ties this perfectly to the Lord's Prayer. I think almost everyone is familiar with the line, "Thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven."
But the sermon reframes it entirely. It's not just a recited line you politely mumble during a Sunday service.
It's framed as an active, desperate, almost aggressive cry for God's justice to be realized in our current incredibly flawed reality.
It transforms the prayer from a passive wish into an active hunger. When you pray, "Thy will be done," you are deliberately looking at the reality of the strong devouring the weak.
You are looking at the rampant injustice and exploitation in the world, and you are declaring, "I am starving for this to be made right."
The hunger for righteousness becomes a hunger for systemic restoration, for the protection of the vulnerable,
and for the equity of God's kingdom to shatter the broken systems of the earth.
It is a revolutionary kind of hunger. It changes the posture of a person from someone merely enduring the world to someone demanding the values of heaven to invade the present moment.
And it makes you look at what we usually hunger for in such a stark, different light.
Think about the things we might feel tempted to quench our thirst with on a daily basis. The world's offerings, the relentless pursuit of entertainment, the desperate, exhausting climb for popularity, the obsessive accumulation of wealth and status.
The sermon suggests that trying to satisfy your deepest divine thirst with these worldly things is exactly like trying to hydrate a dying body by drinking salt water.
That is the perfect, devastating metaphor for the illusion of worldly fulfillment, the salt water of success.
The mechanism of drinking salt water perfectly mirrors our pursuit of earthly success. When you drink salt water momentarily, the physical sensation of liquid hitting your throat tricks your brain into thinking relief is happening.
It feels like hydration.
But biochemically, the heavy salt content requires your body to use even more of its own cellular water just to process the salt. It actively draws moisture out of your vital organs.
You end up infinitely more dehydrated than you were before you took the drink.
The world's offerings never actually satisfy the soul. They only amplify the underlying desperation, demanding that you consume more and more while constantly feeling emptier.
I can't tell you how many times I've fallen for that exact mirage. I think so many of our beloved family members can relate to that cycle.
It's universal.
I've convinced myself that if I just reach a certain metric in my career, or honestly, if I just make a late night online purchase of some new gadget, it will finally bring me this lasting sense of inner peace.
The package arrives, you get that 24-hour spike of excitement, you drink the salt water.
And then by Tuesday, the emptiness creeps right back in, and it somehow feels even larger than before. You are parched, and you are just looking for the next shiny thing to buy.
So what is the actual alternative? The sermon anchors the conversation in the ultimate singular source, bringing in a powerful quote from John 6.35.
Where Jesus declares himself to be the bread of life.
Promising that whoever comes to him will never go hungry, and whoever believes in him will never be thirsty.
The core theological argument here is one of exclusivity, the fundamental human thirst, that deep aching void that drives all our obsessive behaviors, our restless anxieties, and our endless consumption.
Is a thirst designed specifically and exclusively to be quenched by God himself. Therefore, only God can resolve it. Every other pursuit, no matter how noble or glittering it appears, is just salt water.
Here's where it gets really interesting regarding how the world views strength, because the sermon uses another scripture reference that beautifully illustrates this contrast.
Psalm 34:10.
Yes, which talks about young lions. The text says the young lions suffer want and hunger, but those who seek the Lord lack no good thing.
Let's think about a young lion in its prime for a second.
Yeah.
Biologically, it is the apex predator of its environment.
It represents absolute strength, undeniable power, dominance.
The sheer ability to physically take whatever it wants from the world around it. It is the ultimate symbol of being entirely self-sufficient and fiercely independent.
And yet, the text specifically notes that even the young lions will ultimately grow weak and suffer starvation.
It is a stunning, deliberate contrast. The young lions represent the apex predators of our modern society, the billionaires, the massive cultural influencers, the political power brokers.
The ones who seemingly have it all and can command whatever resources they desire.
The text promises that they will ultimately suffer want and hunger because their entire foundation is built on the salt water of the world. Their strength cannot produce spiritual satiation.
But then look at the second half of that profound contrast. Those who seek the Lord lack no good thing.
The people who are actively identifying as empty, the ones who are vulnerable, the ones who are desperately seeking.
They are the ones who are actually completely full. The young lion starves while the weakening seeker is satisfied.
This brings us to the grand synthesis of the entire sermon. True abundance and all truly good things are actually hidden within the poverty and emptiness of desperately seeking God.
They are emphatically not found in the overflowing wealth, status, or power of the world.
Therefore, the very state of being thirsty for God is a profound blessing in and of itself.
Because it acts as a direct, unhindered channel to his grace. The emptiness is the mandatory prerequisite for the filling.
If you are completely full of the world, if your hands are clenched tightly around your own self-sufficiency, there is simply no room for grace to enter.
But if you're starving for righteousness, you are perfectly positioned to receive everything good.
The emptiness is the prerequisite for the filling.
That completely changes how we should view our own internal struggles. If your hands are full of the world's salt water, you can't receive the bread of life. The ache you feel in your soul isn't a curse.
The ache is the blessing making room for the cure.
Which brings us to the core concluding question of the sermon, a question I want to ask directly to you right now. As you sit with this conversation today, in this very moment, what are you hungering and thirsting for?
It is the ultimate diagnostic question for the human soul. If we were to examine the practical daily fruits of our lives, what would they reveal?
It's a sobering audit to run on yourself. If you look closely at your calendar, if you review your bank statements and where your money flows, if you track your screen time and what captures your attention when your mind wanders.
What are those things saying about your true appetite?
The final charge from the sermon is a direct, urgent call to action. Do not settle for your current spiritual state.
If you realize you've been chugging salt water, turn away from those worldly cravings.
Stop trying to fill the eternal void in your chest with temporary things that were never designed to fill it. Instead, actively pray for a holy spiritual appetite. Pray to be made hungry for the right things.
And as we bring our study to a close, I want to leave everyone with a final lingering thought that builds upon the profound themes of this sermon.
Please do.
We live in a highly sophisticated, technologically advanced landscape. We are constantly surrounded by algorithms, social platforms, and targeted advertisements that are literally engineered by some of the smartest minds on the planet to manufacture artificial cravings.
Their entire purpose is to make you desperately thirst for things you absolutely do not need.
What if the daily anxieties, the deep restlessness, and the pervasive fear of missing out that we so commonly experience in our society are actually just misplaced spiritual hunger?
That reframes our entire modern experience.
What would happen if, starting today, you treated every sudden, anxious urge to mindlessly scroll your phone, every impulse to buy something you don't actually need, or every drive to consume empty media as a physical alarm bell?
What if you use those moments not to surrender to the world's saltwater, but as a direct, glaring reminder to check your soul's spiritual hydration?
Using the urge to endlessly scroll as a trigger to seek the presence of God instead.
that is a radically transformative, incredibly practical way to navigate a modern world designed to keep us distracted and dehydrated. Beloved family members, we want to warmly thank you for joining us on this deep exploration of such an impactful, life-altering sermon. We hope that this conversation has stirred something genuine within you.
And we truly wish you a week ahead filled with that blessed, desperate, and ultimately deeply satisfying holy thirst.
Stay hungry, stay thirsty, and we will talk to you next time.